tuned in to People's Tribune Radio. I'm Kenny Shook. On this edition of PTR, we take a critical look at the U.S. war on terrorism.
We need to dig deep, especially as university students. I think, you know, we're in a really good position to use our access to information and public records to really, you know, educate ourselves and to share that education around with others as to what's really going on and to what folks around the world, as well as progressive folks here in the U.S. are saying, and do so with one another in their local contexts and their personal relationships and their families and their relations, because really what we're talking about is taking back the country, giving it back to the people, and making sure that we put into place genuine national democracy.
People's Tribune Radio is brought to you by the League of Revolutionaries for a New America, who also publishes the newspaper People's Tribune, Tribunal del Pueblo. Ordering and contact information will be provided at the end of the program. The war on terror is increasingly taking a toll on U.S. culture and society. As tens of thousands of our troops are abroad fighting terror, families have lost loved ones, gone through divorces, and in addition, every month, thousands lose their job, health care, and many the ability to eat. This war on terror is draining U.S. resources and only benefiting the people who are currently setting its agenda. Tony Zaragoza interviews William Takamatsu Thompson about the stipulations surrounding the so-called war on terror. We begin with Takamatsu Thompson discussing the resignation of Michael Meacher upon Meacher's discovery of the plans that the Project for a New American Century had developed prior to the war on terror.
Meacher was a senior official in British Prime Minister Tony Blair's administration. Now, he resigned from his post this past June after learning of a secret report published 1 year before 9/11 by the neoconservative think tank, the Project for a New American Century, also known as PNAC, which Meacher and many others have since been speaking out against to media around the world. The report was entitled Rebuilding America's Defenses and was published in September of 2000 and really served as the backbone for Bush's national security strategy, which the administration released to the public in September of 2002. The PNAC report showed that Bush's cabinet had fully intended to take complete military control of the Persian Gulf region long before September 11th, whether or not Saddam Hussein was to be in power. The report stated that, quote, while the unresolved conflict with Iraq provides the immediate justification, the need for a substantial American force presence in the Gulf transcends the issue of the regime of Saddam Hussein. This was from The Guardian, dated September 6th of this year. So, toward these ends, the PNAC blueprint really outlined four core objectives for U.S. military forces, again, drafted just 1 year before September 11th. These are their words. First, to defend the American homeland. Second, to fight and decisively win multiple simultaneous major theater wars. Third, perform the, quote, constabulary, unquote, duties associated with shaping the security environment in critical regions, and to transform U.S. forces to exploit the, quote, revolution in military affairs, as they called it. Now, PNAC's co-chair, Donald Kagan, even argued that the U.S., quote, will probably need a major concentration of forces in the Middle East over a long period of time, saying that if we have force in Iraq, there'll be no disruption in oil supplies. Basically, the report demonstrates that the expansion of U.S. military supremacy in the Persian Gulf was intended well before September 11th as a means of ensuring uncontested control of Iraq's oil resources, which, not coincidentally, happened to be the second largest in the world, and served as the Bush administration's real motivation for the invasion of Iraq, not, as the administration argued, Saddam Hussein. And so I guess just real quick I would say, or ask, who are the brains behind the PNAC? And our listeners would be interested to hear the folks who are affiliated with this group. They include Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, Paul Wolfowitz, who served as Rumsfeld's deputy in the DOD, Department of Defense. Also included George Bush's younger brother, Jeb Bush, and Dick Cheney's chief of staff, Louis Libby. Other members of PNAC include John Bolton, who's now the Undersecretary of State, Stephen Cambone, who's head of the Pentagon's Office of Program Analysis and Evaluation, Elliot Cohen and Devin Cross, who are members of the Defense Policy Board, which is one of the main advisory boards for Rumsfeld, Dov Zakheim, who serves as the comptroller for the Defense Department, Bruce Jackson, now with Lockheed Martin, a major defense contractor, and William Kristol, who, some listeners might be aware, writes for the conservative weekly Standard, which is actually owned by Rupert Murdoch, owner of the international media giant Fox News and a leading supporter of the war against Iraq. You know, it's also important to note here that PNAC's blueprint follows an earlier document produced in 1992 by Wolfowitz and Libby for George Bush Sr. This document was entitled Defense Policy Guidance. And even then, in the early 90s, these people were arguing that the U.S. must, quote, discourage advanced industrial nations from challenging U.S. leadership or even aspiring to a larger regional or global role, and referred to key U.S. allies such as Britain as the most effective and efficient means of exercising American global leadership. They went on to say that even should Saddam pass from the scene, this is their words, U.S. military bases in Saudi Arabia and Kuwait will remain permanently, as Iran may well prove as large a threat to U.S. interests as Iraq has. It then highlights China for regime change, stating that it's time to increase the presence of American forces in Southeast Asia, and even hints that the U.S. may consider developing biological weapons, quote, that can target specific genotypes and may transform biological warfare from the realm of terror to a politically useful tool. That's their words. Finally, this group spotlights North Korea, Syria, and Iran as dangerous regimes, and saying that their existence justifies the creation of a, quote, worldwide command and control system. I think these are some of the reasons why Meacher and so many others are now calling the so-called war on terrorism, and the arguments that Bush and his cabinet used to justify it, absolutely bogus. Even U.S. Representative David Obey, who's the ranking member of the Foreign Operations Subcommittee of the House Appropriations Committee, has basically called this whole operation nothing short of a disaster. Even early last week, Representative John Murtha, who's kind of the hawkish ranking member of the powerful Appropriations Defense Subcommittee, and himself a highly decorated Vietnam veteran who strongly supported the war, is calling for, quote, high-level resignations in light of what he called the misrepresentations by the administration that led to the war and the situation and its aftermath. He basically accepted blame early last week for believing what the administration told him before the war, and for his part, apologized to the American people, saying that, quote, I am part of it. I admit the mistake. He went on to say that some bureaucrat in Washington has to start paying the price. We cannot allow these bureaucrats to get off when these young people are paying such a price. So I think it's pretty clear what the real priorities of the Bush administration's foreign policies are. I mean, they really have little to do with any so-called war on terror, and everything to do with securing uncontested domination of the planet's energy resources and sending young men and women from the U.S., mostly people of color and working-class whites, to sacrifice their lives as a means of ensuring the state of affairs. And the horrific attacks of September 11th just gave the administration the ideal pretext to implement this plan, which is being developed, as I indicated, by Bush's advisors and members of his current cabinet during the 1990s. And I would just note as a closing comment here that all of these documents are now in the public domain and really help us connect the dots.
And where might be some places where folks can see some of those documents that you were quoting from?
Well, the Project for a New American Century can be accessed just by hitting in a Google search. And, you know, a lot of stuff will come up on the PNAC, including this infamous report that they published in 2000. They were formally organized in 1997, though their principal players were kind of on the scene long before then under Bush Sr.'s administration, and in the case of Rumsfeld and Cheney, go all the way back to Nixon and Vietnam.
So, William, we're talking about something like 120,000 troops now in Iraq, and though the administration attempts to avoid the term, many folks are calling what the U.S. is doing in Iraq an occupation, even an illegal occupation. Would you call it that? Would you call it an occupation? And if so, what do you mean by the term, and why would you call it an occupation?
I think we need to remember as a basic matter that any time a military force is sent to another country, that country is being occupied by a foreign military. U.S. policy planners are fond of telling us that such military assistance is requested and desired by the host governments, for example, and that therefore the term occupation is inappropriate. But, you know, if you look at it closely, this really rests on an erroneous assumption that national governments, any national government, truly represent the people. But We know this isn't always the case. Saddam Hussein, to take only one example, was himself propped up by the U.S. government in the 1980s after being groomed by the CIA as far back as the late 1950s and early 1960s as a means of maintaining dictatorial control of the Iraqi population in support of U.S. economic interests. He was never democratically elected. Even if U.S. military forces were in fact welcomed by the majority of Iraq's citizens, and there's every reason to believe that they weren't in the initial days when they moved into Baghdad, why is it that more U.S. soldiers have been killed since Bush declared the war is allegedly over than during the invasion itself? The answer is pretty obvious. Bush lied to the American people. Our military is not welcomed by the people of Iraq, and thus they're fighting back.
Well, William, would you say that there are other such illegal occupations going on? And if so, could you talk about them for us?
Absolutely. Just at the present time, just a couple of examples. You know, at the same time, the Bush administration is now spending $150 million every day for the occupation of Iraq. It's been spending billions more for counterinsurgency operations in Colombia and the Philippines, sending thousands of U.S. troops to the southern Philippines over the last 2 years alone. The Philippines, in fact, has been designated by the Bush administration as its so-called second front in the war on terrorism. Now, the Congress has approved these appropriations, so as far as the administration is concerned, these operations are not quote-unquote illegal in the narrow sense of this term. But, you know, we could ask, why the Philippines? Why is the Philippines Bush's second front in the war on terrorism, so-called? Well, to answer that, you know, we need to look at both the political economy of the Asia-Pacific region, as well as the history of U.S. relations with Asia and the Pacific over the last century. Aside from its geostrategic location as a buffer zone for the Middle East, the U.S. has considered itself for more than a century the dominant hegemonic power in Asia and in the Pacific, having conquered Samoa, Hawaii, Guam, and the Philippines, and invaded China earlier in the century to repress the Boxer Rebellion. And in addition to that, it's also fought three major wars in Asia. There are vast oil and gas reserves in Indonesia and Brunei, as well as in Vietnam, Malaysia, and the Philippines. In fact, U.S. trade with Asia-Pacific surpasses that with Europe, with more than $500 billion in trade and foreign direct investment of more than $150 billion. In the case of Southeast Asia generally, the region has a combined gross national product of $700 billion, with $35 billion in direct U.S. investment just in the Philippines, Thailand, Malaysia, and Indonesia alone, making the region the U.S.'s fifth largest trading partner. According to the Council on Foreign Relations, which is one of Bush's primary advisors, Southeast Asia is, quote, a place of great geopolitical consequence that sits aside some of the world's most critical sea lanes, unquote. They write that more than $1.3 trillion in merchandise trade passed through the Strait of Malacca and Lombok in 1999, which is in the Sea of China. And that constitutes nearly half of all world trade, including crucial supplies from the Persian Gulf to Japan, South Korea, and China. So the South China Sea, particularly Spratlys and Paracels, are believed to have significant oil reserves, according to their planning. So, when Bush talks about the Philippines and Southeast Asia as being the second front, what he's really saying is that it's the second front for a war on people by big business.
You are listening to People's Tribune Radio. Tony Zaragoza is interviewing William Takamatsu Thompson about the current state of the war on terrorism during a live interview conducted on Community Forum Radio at KZUU in Pullman, Washington.
And William, we have now something like 70 countries with U.S. bases. Well,
that's
now
right.
71 if we count Iraq.
That's right.
And we have troops in 156 countries. And I was wondering if you could talk about the role of the U.S. military around the world generally. Why is the U.S. military so spread out around the globe?
There's a really good quote by Smedley Butler. He was a major general in the U.S. Marine Corps, who retired in the 1930s. And in 1933, he wrote these following words. I spent 33 years and 4 months in active military service as a member of this country's most agile military force, the Marine Corps. And during that period, I spent most of my time being a high-class muscle man for big business, for Wall Street, and for the bankers. The trouble is that when the dollar only earns 6% over here in the U.S., Butler wrote, then it gets restless and goes overseas to get 100%. Then the flag follows the dollar, and the soldiers follow the flag. This, in fact, prompted Butler to flat out say that he, quote, would not go to war again as I've done to protect some lousy investment of the bankers. So I think that sums it up pretty well.
Okay, so there are all these troops around the world who are basically, as Butler himself, a member of the military, admitted gangsters for capital interests. Well, what about the troops themselves? What should we do about the 120,000 troops in Iraq and the other 200,000 U.S. troops around the world?
Well, for starters, people around the world and in the U.S. are demanding that all U.S. troops immediately be brought back home. All U.S. military bases abroad should be decommissioned and military personnel be given meaningful work for meeting human needs here in the U.S.
You mean like building hospitals or schools?
Hospitals and daycare centers and rebuilding infrastructure, dilapidated infrastructure in our cities, providing aid and service to folks who are struggling out in the countryside, in the rural areas. I mean, it's no surprise to most working people in the U.S. and middle-class Americans, even increasingly more and more, that we're in a serious state of economic crisis, and we are really beginning to see the roots of this crisis. We have the ability to change things around if we just kind of start sharing experiences and really start protecting our young people from being taken down just so that they can serve these suits upstairs. Most obvious question is how many of the Bush administration's children are fighting in Iraq? How many of their children are fighting in Afghanistan? And you know, I think that gives us a pretty clear answer. The answer is zero. So bring them home. Bring them home.
Let me ask you another question here. Maybe if we can get a little more historical as well. How does the current administration's foreign policy fit into this country's foreign policy history? In other words, is what we're seeing now anything qualitatively new?
I would answer definitively no. We're not seeing anything qualitatively new. There are some commentators out there and analysts and folks in general who one group is arguing that the Bush administration really signifies an aberration in U.S. foreign policy, and they will point to Bush's so-called preemptive war doctrine that was released in their national security strategy in 2000 that I made mention of earlier. They'll point to that and argue that this doctrine of preemptive war is really an anomaly in U.S. foreign policy history and in U.S. international relations. Therefore, you know, we need to just kind of focus on these folks as something that's out of the norm of U.S. policy. But, you know, any even casual glance at U.S. history will really reveal just the opposite. William Bloom, who wrote just a marvelous book entitled Rogue State, A Guide to the World's Only Superpower, has documented at least 67 U.S. military interventions around the world since 1945 alone. That's 67 military interventions. And in fact, in many of those cases, one sees a very similar pattern has emerged here since 9/11, which one finds a large, major, or significant attack, in these cases, on international soil, which is then used as a pretext for sending in massive amounts of military aid, and the U.S., through the Central Intelligence Agency, setting up dictatorial, tyrannical regimes that serve their interests. You know, the minute that these dictators choose to bite back the hand that feeds them, in the case of Saddam Hussein, then the U.S. sets them up as a pretext for yet more military aid, more counterinsurgency, and more direct military interventions on those countries. All of these dynamics were drawn from the wars of extermination and genocide that the U.S. Imposed upon and committed against Native Americans from 1619 up to the present day, these policies of extermination, the scorched earth policy and so forth, were developed in the context of westward expansion and settlement here in the United States, and applied in the case of the late 19th century in the Philippines between 1898 and 1916. In that case alone, over 1.7 million Filipinos were slaughtered, again, in the name of U.S. foreign policy objectives. Now, you know, all of these activities, you know, really serve as a backdrop, an historical backdrop to Vietnam. So, really, you know, I think your question is really good, because it really helps us kind of identify what the historical linkages are with what's going on now.
This is People's Tribune Radio. William Takumatsu Thompson focuses on the relationships involved with conducting the War on Terror during a live interview with correspondent Tony Zaragoza.
You know, talking about things here in the U.S., what does the Bush administration foreign policy have to do with domestic policy? How does it affect what's happening here within the borders of the United States?
I mentioned earlier that the Bush administration is spending over $150 million every day on this war in Iraq. And as folks know, has recently requested over $87 billion more for the next year alone. These are our tax dollars. These are U.S. taxpayer dollars. And it's occurring, moreover, at a time in which millions of Americans have been put out of work. The unemployment rate is increasing. We're in the midst of a so-called jobless recovery. The situation is only being intensified by these expenditures through the Bush administration. We're constantly told that there aren't enough funds to meet human needs, but there's never a shortage of dollars for war and hate. And so, see, these are some of the contradictions. Our monies are being spent on these wars for domination of the world's energy supplies, while we here in the United States are paying the price. And that's not to mention the thousands and thousands of innocent people around the world who are being killed, dying every day as a result of these arrogant policies.
Our lives here don't seem any more secure. In fact, the situation for most people is getting worse. So with the energy stuff that you mentioned, who's benefiting from these policies?
I think it's pretty clear by now who the real beneficiaries of this sham war on terrorism are. We can look at it in terms of particular individuals. I've mentioned Cheney, Rumsfeld, Wolfowitz, Jeb Bush, Condoleezza Rice. I've mentioned their ties to corporate America. But, you know, let's look at the corporations themselves. You know, we don't even need to look at, you know, particular individuals, though that's important. I mean, the organizations themselves, these multinational corporations that are benefiting from these policies. Got a list here. Andrew Card, who's the White House Chief of Staff, has ties to GM. Condoleezza Rice herself has ties to, specifically, Chevron, Charles Schwab, and Transamerica. Mitch Daniels, who's Director of the Office of Management and Budget. These are all cabinet members for Bush, General Electric and Citigroup. Secretary of the Interior, Gail Norton, Ford Motors. Elaine Chao, who's Bush's Labor Secretary, Bank of America and Northwest Airlines. Paul O'Neill, who's the Secretary of the Treasury, is tied to Lucent Technologies and Alcoa. Anthony Principe, who's the Secretary for Veteran Affairs, has worked with Lockheed Martin and Qualcomm. I mean, the list just goes on. Again, these are some of the reasons why Meacher and so many others are now calling the so-called war on terrorism and the arguments that Bush and his cabinet used to justify just absolutely bogus. And these are the folks who are benefiting from this so-called war on terror, while the rest of folks here in the U.S. and around the world are paying the price with their lives and their sovereignty and their freedom and the basic necessities of life, health care, education, food, clean water, just the basics even.
So it sounds like there are a lot of you know, really large corporations who are benefiting from our military being around the world, from, you know, people's family members' lives being on the line under the guise of security. But we're not any more secure. William, I'm wondering, you know, as we finish the interview, if you could maybe talk to us a little bit about what your definition of security might be. What's an alternative view of security that we can start thinking about?
We really need to immediately recall all of our troops back here to the U.S. I mentioned earlier, I mean, it's no surprise now. It's been all over the news, and the administration is trying to run for cover from the fact that more U.S. service people have now been killed since Bush declared the formal cessation of hostilities, that this war, this so-called war, was over, than during the invasion itself. That's not security. Here in Washington and Idaho, hundreds and hundreds of young people are faced with little to no economic opportunities for their futures, and so have little choice but to turn to the military unless they want to be flipping hamburgers for McDonald's. I mean, this is the only work that's left for folks, even with college degrees. And so what's left? Clearly, we need to emphasize a new role, a radically different role for the United States in the world economy. And I think along those lines, grassroots organizations, democratic people's organizations are emerging here in the United States and around the world, are really the ones that are proposing, you know, democratic accountability and holding our elected officials responsible for their actions and to truly represent the needs of the people, basic necessities, health care, public education, care for the elderly. These things are being wantonly ripped off by the Bush administration, all in the name of these massive expenditures that are leaving the economy and going into destructive policies of war and hate. So my definition of security would include the opposite of all of these kinds of measures, and they would be based upon, you know, really a new ethos of cooperation and sense of solidarity between peoples here in the United States and around the world, in opposition to really what's globally just a small handful of individuals who are trying to call the shots and run the show at the expense of our dollars and of our livelihoods and of people's very lives. Thousands and thousands and thousands of progressive organizations working around these issues on a number of different levels in the United States and around the world. And hook up with these organizations, hook up with other like-minded folks and other unlike-minded folks, and start doing the same thing. Just start educating each other, educating ourselves, and putting into practice what we want an alternative to be, which is a cooperative society that's not based on hate, competition, war, and violence.
It is up to us, the people, in order to see such a society come to fruition. That is it for this edition of PTR. People's Tribune Radio is part of the League of Revolutionaries for a New America. The League advocates for a cooperative society where the billions spent on the war on terror are rather used at home for food, clothing, and shelter. If you would like a copy of today's program, a speaker, or any of our other print and media resources, call us at 1-800-691-6888. That's 1-800-691-6888. You may also visit us on the internet at www.lrna.org. I'm Kenny Shook, and on behalf of the League of Revolutionaries for a New America, I want to ask you to please join us next time for another edition of People's Tribune Radio.